Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I was super excited to have Gillian Davis. Gillian is an expert in leadership development with a fascinating journey that began in her family's executive recruitment business in Canada. She co-authored the book First Time Leader at just 28 years old and has since made a significant impact in the tech world, working with companies like WeTransfer, MessageBird, and Spotify. As the founder of Overtime Leader, Gillian focuses on practical leadership strategies that align with business goals, especially in the ever-changing modern environment of tech and venture. In today's episode, we talk about how to go from fampany to a company, how founder's time is currency, the three types of founder archetypes, and what does culture even mean?
We had to build the culture from the ground up. I think most people, when they talk about culture, don't really know what it means.
How great leadership balances between being directive and facilitative, and how you should build a playbook that works for you.
Don't be apologetic about the kind of company you're trying to build, because there are people for every type of company.
How stopping a me over a we mentality can help break down silos, and how you should take three bets and forget the rest.
These are the three bets we're gonna make. And that means you can't have 15 bets. And that means some people will not be reflected in these bets.
Whether VC has too many closed circles and closed doors, and Gillian's contrarian advice when building a company.
As it relates to building a company, there is a time and place for tyranny.
Let's get straight into it. Hey guys, whilst I've got you for a second, I just thought I'd reintroduce myself. My name's Arish. I'm the host of Nothing Ventured, the podcast where I talk to the people behind the stories that make the venture ecosystem go round. I'm also the founder of Emerge One, a consultancy that provides fractional CFO support to venture-backed tech startups from seed to Series B and beyond. If you like the podcast, we would really appreciate it if you could subscribe and rate wherever you listen. And if there is anything that you want to tell me about either the pod or guests that you might want to see on the pod in the future, do connect with me on LinkedIn or Twitter. I'd be really happy to hear from you. Right, let's get back into it. Gillian, really great to have you in the studio with me. Thank you so much for joining.
Thanks for having me.
Amazing. There are so many topics I want to get into with you because there are, I think, some parallels between our lives. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about one of those, right? So you and I have both seen or navigated the shift from a founder-led family business, which you refer to as a fampany, which I think I'm going to have to now secondarily coin, to a more structured company,
yeah.
Right? So how can owner-led businesses make that transition more effectively? And what are the challenges that you see as these owner-operated companies are forced to grow up into a more professionalized sort of organization?
Yes. And full disclosure, It's secondary stolen from someone else.
Oh, damn it.
Mills at S2, I want to give him the credit.
Okay.
But yeah, fampany, I think, is a great way of how we all feel when we start a business. Mm. We're so close to our early employees. We're so attached to it as well. But as we've all seen, as you scale, not everything scales with you. And I saw this firsthand actually working in my dad's business. Mm. He unfortunately was diagnosed with Parkinson's in his mid-50s.
Wow.
And the business was his namesake. He was the founder of business development. He was everything. And so he was literally signed off of work the day he was diagnosed because stress is a trigger for Parkinson's.
Yep.
Fortunately, he's still living with it 20 years on.
Wow. Congratulations.
So we've been very fortunate.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the business didn't make it. We weren't, we thought about succession for everyone else but ourselves.
Yeah.
And that's when I really stepped in to start, and I saw just firsthand the chaos, the mess that can happen when a founder who we think is, superhuman and will never pass or never fail.
Yeah.
Just all the things we should have put in place to just manage that a bit better. Mm. And then moving into venture and working with founders and just seeing how, as you scale, your leadership needs to scale. You need to shift. Your team needs to shift. What got you to 0 to 30 is not going to get you to 0 to 300 and won't get you to 0 to 3,000. Mm. So I think it's so important for founders early on to just, it's easier said than done, but really think about what does this look like at 300 people?
Mm.
And there's a bias called the halo effect. And I think we don't realize that as founders, I know we look in the mirrors and we see ourselves. We see our insecurities and our imposter, but what other people see is a phenomenal person who's leading a vision that no one else could.
Mm.
you start to get that halo effect. It starts to build more and more the more successful you are. Mm. And
that sort of feeling that I can't go wrong.
No, not internally. Some have it.
Externally. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So time with you is currency. Mm. And that's one of the things I start to see as a founder raises the scale of the team. The early employees who were so used to them being around all the time, being in meetings, well, when you start to put layers in between, they start to associate that time with you as value. Mm. And when I see you less and less, or you're not with me, have I done something wrong? I've messed up. People get quite emotional about it. So just thinking about how do you create or let people know that this is going to happen, because it happens. It's a natural evolution of the business. And I think we sometimes, I've seen this enough times to now assume it's a pattern. The people that are right for the early stages are not always the right people for the next stage. And there's always that moment, tends to be after a Series A raise, maybe 12 months to 18 months after, we start to realize, ooh, maybe these people are not on this bus anymore. And a lot of people hold on too long.
At founder level, right.
They hold on to those people for too long. Mm. They try to make it work. Those people become quite toxic, holding on to the past, and this is how things used to be. And then when they do a restructuring or they let people go, they catastrophize it and make promises that they can't keep, like, we're never going to do this again. Mm. And what I try to get founders to understand is actually you need to normalize the evolution of the business, and that means things will grow, processes will come in, people are going to leave. We should celebrate that people leave. One of the first companies I worked for, their HR director was so proud of this really high attrition rate. Mm. Like, no one leaves, which was crazy for the industry they were in. Mm. And then I got in there and I realized, well, we need people to leave. Mm. That stat actually could afford to go down a little bit because we've got complacency, people are comfortable. And most importantly, they're afraid to leave because the founder, every time someone goes on their own volition, stands up at an all hands and says, can I swear?
Yeah, of course.
Like, fuck them. We don't need them anyways.
Yeah.
So then you're like creating this environment where people who should go, because maybe they've like tapped out, they're ready for the next thing, stay just to be part of the culture because it's so strong.
Yeah.
And so in that founder, we got him to realize, you know, celebrate when people leave, also because we want to encourage it, and create an alumni. Mm. It's not a personal attack that someone is leaving the business. Mm. Like, we need to disassociate that a little bit. And we created one of the most strongest self-run. Mm. He's not involved. No one in leadership is involved in this alumni. Powerful alumni that's going on 10 years later. Mm. So I think it's about just, detaching yourself from people a little bit. Know that the people that get you, that are in that early team with you today, are not necessarily going to be there. It's likely that your first engineer is going to have to be a head of research at one point and not a CTO of a, you know, company that's going to exit. Normalize the fact that this is an evolution. Things happen, like nature, things die, we move on. And we've got to just make that part of the process instead of these big shock moments that are going to happen.
I mean, so many things that come out of there for me. I mean, I write about this a lot, and I think it's something that it kind of follows on from what you said, which is, you know, you are not your business, right? So the emotional attachment to the business can be so overpowering and overwhelming for many people, because every moment that, you know, there is a cash crunch or they've got to let people go, they take it as a real personal slight. Mm. And it isn't, right? Like, I mean, most people do not think in the way that a founder does about the founder's business. Now, they may think like a founder in and of themselves and may go on to create their own businesses, but no one is ever going to have the emotional attachment to your business as much as you do as a founder, even your earliest employees, right? And to your point, right, exactly that. Your CTO at pre-seed is not necessarily going to be your CTO at Series B. And frankly, probably shouldn't be, because the sort of skill set you need to run, you know, an organization as a CTO at Series B or Series C or beyond, it's so different. It's more about managing. It's about architecture. It's about, you know, driving projects rather than necessarily doing the stuff that needs to be done, right? Which is obviously a lot of what happens with early stage employees. And then the second thing I think is, which again leads from that, right, is that the majority of the world are employees, right? The majority of the world are workforce rather than founders. And it took me a long time to kind of figure this out, right? Because I went on this, you know, we should have more founders and, you know, why would you ever be an employee? You could build your own business. Mm-hmm. It's amazing. And, oh, wow, the tax breaks are great as well, kind of thing. And then I actually sat back and I thought about it. And this is really great quote. So I used to work with a business called Eaton X, which was founded by Eaton College and was a JV with Founders Factory. And our course was a leadership, leadership course. Mm. And we were predominantly selling into China when we first started. And I remember at one town hall with a school, and our sort of business dev exec was there. She recounted the story back to us. One of the students stood up and said, "But you know, if everyone's going to be leader, who's going to be the labor?" And I think, I mean, very Chinese way of putting it, or certainly a PRC way of putting it, but it rings true, right? Like you can found a business, but if you don't have people that are going to work for you, then what do you have? And employees have a life cycle, right? Now, I think, you know, my sister, I talk about this as well. My sister has worked with the same company since she graduated. That is not the norm in any business, and certainly not in a startup environment where actually, like, you never know from year to year whether this business is going to succeed or fail or be different. Mm. And therefore you are going to look for, you know, those opportunities elsewhere. And the final thing that again really resonates, because I went through this last year, not that we're scaled at a sort of Series A, B type of level, but part of my business is to bring in more and more CFOs into kind of our community. And at that stage, you cannot rely on me knowing every single one of those CFOs individually and personally to the level that, you know, I can confidently then turn around and say, well, okay, this business, this CFO, this makes sense. I need to have a good idea. But what we spent a lot of last year doing was putting those processes in place such that we could do that sort of effectively. I guess the question I would have from everything that you've said and everything that I've just said as well is, do you often come across founders that are self-aware enough that they understand that transition needs to be made? Or is it all, I mean, I guess the nature of what you do means, you know, and again, this is, you know, the success heuristic, I guess you are always going to come across the founders that don't know that because you're coaching them through that. Or maybe you do come across the founders that do know that but need help being coached through that practice. But where would you say most founders kind of?
I think there's like three types.
Yeah.
There's those that hire us in to be validated and are like, I know what I'm doing. Thank you. Moving on. Need to learn my own lessons.
Yeah.
Those who are completely unaware and get quite a shock factor for when it happens, because it's one thing to read about it or hear about it, another thing for it to happen to you.
Yeah, experience it. Yeah.
And I think, you know, I'm an entrepreneur as well. Like, we read things and we're like, that won't happen to me. So I think there's sometimes this denial curve or like, no, it's not really happening. And like, it's happening. Mm. And then those that, and I feel, you know, I've been doing this for 7+ years. I feel I'm seeing more and more of this other type of founder who get it. They've read about it. They've heard about it. Mm. And they do not want to waste the time and the mess of not doing it right. Mm. And they're the best to work with.
Yeah. So, exactly. The ones that are self-aware, coachable, understand, like, want to see around the corner, know, you know, have seen enough outside to not want to have to go through that and therefore take the advice early. And is there kind of, can you try and start thinking about this transition too early, or is?
Yeah. I mean, like, we have this workshop called Prepare for Scale. Mm. And that's actually designed for 12 months after you've raised. Mm. Because if I come in too early and tell you this is going to happen, again, you'll get like, yeah, well, thank you, but I don't think that's going to happen to us because look at all these great people I have. But then sure enough, you add, you know, 50 people in 5 months and things get a little messy. Mm. So I think it's important, or it's like when I come across seed stage founders asking for company values, like product market fit first, then we start, the values are there. But don't build anything too soon.
They're not written necessarily. They're just how we do things.
Like, you are the culture.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But don't, like, spend any time, especially if you don't have product market fit, don't spend any time like crafting a culture, because it, as soon as you get product market fit and you get validation, it's going to change.
Yeah.
So yes, it's sometimes too early. I think it's just top of mind, like, or back of mind, be thinking about this stuff. And I always say, like, imagine the roadmap, like, if everything worked out, you got X customer, you raised X amount, who are you hiring? What does your life look like? And then what are the processes around? Just brainstorm that, mind map it, throw it away, put it somewhere. But just have that like way back of mind, because we fall into these habits that are very hard for someone like me to undo. And not just in the founder, but imagine the leadership team that are conditioned to behave in a certain way. I mean, there was one person, I always say, if you want to get a real feel for change management, move an office space around, move desks around. This one person was so like emotionally upset at his desk move.
Wow.
Senior executive.
Yeah.
And I had to like sit him down because he was, you know, caused.
And this presumably wasn't a WeWork at this point.
No, no, no. Yeah. He was in an office and I was like, these people are moving over there. You know, the design team that support this team, sales team, they're going to move over with all the other designers and yeah, you're going to sit here, whatever. He got very upset, became distracting from the announcement. So I had to take him out for a walk. Like, what's going on? What's really going on? He was like, well, if the designer is sitting somewhere else, I can't yell at them when I need design changes. I was like, well,
might have to get over that.
Let's get over that. And also, we're about to open offices in New York and LA.
You're not going to be able to yell at them.
So let's get used to global processes. And this is your opportunity. Yeah. So yeah, people get very attached to things. And I often say, like, if you just think about this stuff early on and catch things early, you don't, no one, not everyone has to hire a me. But if you do those things, it will be a lot cheaper when you have to hire in a me. Because to bring in a behavior change consultant, when you have people that are like emotionally attached to a desk,
it gets expensive. Might be a bit too late. Yeah. I mean, I guess the question that flows from there is like, is there ever, I would assume there are some red flags that may say to you, you know, to your point, if the founder isn't coachable, hasn't sort of thought about this, then it might be harder to work with them. But are there companies that have gotten so entrenched in how they do things that it's just almost impossible to kind of unpick?
Yeah. And I think it, you know, there's been times where a founder comes and they're like, we need to change. And we look into it and we, you know, come back with like, here's what you need to do. And I think when you've got a company that's very ingrained in the way things were, my belief is you then do a little bit of shock factor to signal that things are going to be different. And if a founder isn't comfortable or isn't willing to do that, to do the hard things, then, you know, find someone else to work with you.
Yeah, it's interesting, actually, just whilst you were saying that, I was working, I was coaching sort of a senior finance person in a business. It was, you know, somewhat... you know, had done quite well, but in the sort of new venture market that's been in place, it's not new, the old venture market that's come back, you know, over the last couple of years, you know, fundraising was harder, things were tougher, runways were tighter. They needed to make some significant changes in headcount, but the founder was like really, really resistant to doing anything, to the extent that, you know, they were getting very close to the wire and wanted to do it kind of drib drab, like we'll make some small cut and then we'll maybe do some others. And I said to this kind of finance lead, I was like, that's just wrong, because all that will happen is you make the small number of cuts, you leave the door wide open for people to think, well, there's more on the way.
Yeah.
And they're going to start picking up, you know, picking up the phone to their, you know, recruitment consultant or whatever and saying, hey, listen, I need, you know, I need a backstop here. And it would just be much better to just kind of do it one shot, you know, go deep, go hard, make the right cuts. Obviously you don't want to be sort of, you know, you obviously are not doing it from a place of, you know, scorn or negativity, but you know, when in business, you have to do things, do it right, do it the right way, but do it, you know, once, hopefully, so that, you know, you can steady the ship as quickly as possible and keep people kind of on track. And especially in a startup, right? Like that's happening all the time.
And I think we have to come down to like what's best for the business.
Yeah.
And sometimes that doesn't mean it's going to be the best thing for everyone.
Yeah.
But if we do everything for everyone, we won't have a business.
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably no surprise to anyone who's been in this industry over the past few years. The big theme of the work for the past, you know, 2 years has been refactoring companies.
Yeah.
And
I mean, like as CFOs, that's like 90% is, okay, how do we make this company more efficient?
Exactly. Yeah. And there was a founder I was working with that, to your point, waited till the last minute, and it was tricky. He had hired friends or hired people that became friends that were not fit for the role anymore. And it's really hard, but it watched for about a good 12 months. Mm. A key decision not being made about letting someone go who was not doing their job, which was a critical job for the business. He started to lose respect of the employees. Mm. And when they started making drib-drab cuts, everyone was like, but
why is that guy?
Yeah. Yeah. And then we start a whole other bit of problems. So eventually, I mean, got the board involved, blah, blah, blah. They made the hard calls. And then they did a big round of cuts. And it is a balance from a comms perspective, and the amount of restructuring comms we've had to do in the past few years is, could write a playbook on it.
Up there, yeah.
But that balance of like, yes, you need to, you know, be empathetic. Absolutely. It's not, it's about business. It's not something you'd want to do. Let people know, like, do it with compassion. Mm. But at the same time, you still have a group of folks that are on the other side. Mm. And it's a very interesting balance so that, you know, in, especially if you're doing in the UK, the redundancy process can take quite a few weeks. And the folks that you want to keep, you want to retain, can't really speak to them. Mm. But you also have to start to nudge and make it interesting of why you would stay on the other side. Mm. And what is this company on the other side?
Yeah.
And in this case, you know, the company on the other side needed to be a completely different company. Mm. And we had to, like, build the culture from the ground up. Mm. I think most people, when they talk about culture, don't really know what it means. But no,
it's a very kind of up in the air term.
Yeah,
it's a bit like woke.
Yeah,
no one really knows what it means. Yeah,
but in this case, you know, it was things like they're running out of money. It's crisis time, in my opinion. It's like crazy crisis time, and we did an audit of all their internal comm moments, and they mentioned that they do this weekly company all hands. Mm. And it's a space where people talk about community and different holidays, and people love it. I was like, okay, well, that needs to go right now. And they're like, well, no, people really love it. I was like, if the key message is we need to, like, get business, no holidays.
This is not a vacation.
It's not. And, like, you are creating a complete disassociation to what the reality of the business is and what people are doing. Mm. Everyone in this company, I don't care what they do, needs to be adding value to getting this ship back on track. Mm. And they were like, no.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, that's when you're not willing to do the things that you have to do.
That, yeah. So I mean, again, I completely understand that from a family perspective, you know, in a family, I'm sure you've seen this yourself, right? But if I think about it from my kind of family business heritage, it's the same as, well, how do you fire a brother or a cousin? Yeah. Right.
Which I've had to do.
Yeah. Which it's not pleasant. Right.
No.
And not only is it not pleasant, but you got to go around for the family dinner a couple of days later and act like nothing's changed. Right. And,
yep.
And I think, I mean, what you described there is, I think a lot of founders, I might be being very harsh here, but I get the impression that a lot of founders do not realize the reality of building a business, right? And look, whilst cash was flowing freely, everyone was able to kind of jump on the bandwagon. But there is a reason, to my earlier point, where many people are part of the workforce rather than the business builders. Building a business is fundamentally different. You have to disassociate. You can be colleagues. You can even be friends to an extent, but there has to be, like, that veneer of disassociation, such that, to your point, when the hard calls need to be made, the hard calls can be made. But also, you can celebrate the good, like, because what you want to be able to do is, okay, if XYZ person is your mate and they've done something really well, you don't want to celebrate their win and have the rest of the team think, well, it's the boss's mate, of course they're celebrating the win, right?
Yeah.
Like, you want to be able to treat everyone with the respect that they deserve and give them their dues, right? Which when you run a business, and going back to the original point, when you run a business as a fampany, that becomes hard. It actually did take me a while to get my head around I think you should have a happy workforce 100%. But I remember working with one founder, and this founder said, you know, he was on a call with his investors or his board, I can't remember now which it was. And he said to them, listen, do you want our employee NPS to be high, or do you want us to book revenue? I don't necessarily think that those two things are not interlinked, right? Yeah. They're exactly mutually exclusive. But I sort of see his point, not that I agree with it entirely, because I think he went down the complete other end of the spectrum. But you have to be able to strike the balance between, yeah, okay, you want a happy workforce, but you also got to deliver the results, right? If you've got a happy workforce that is literally sitting back and, you know, having a bit of fun and, you know, taking selfies and TikToks about, you know, company lunches and and lattes, that isn't gonna get it done, right?
It's fine when times are good.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it needs to shift with what's going on in the business. If you're struggling for revenue, then all hands on deck revenue.
Yeah.
If we're good, we're good. Let's take some selfies.
Yeah. I'm not. Yeah, I mean, maybe. I mean, I think it should be all hands on deck, irrespective of what's happening.
Yes.
But you can have a bit more leeway, I guess, maybe during the good times. Look, I want to move on because we have a lot to get through. And frankly, there's some stuff that I think requires a bit of nuance and thinking in terms of how we unpick it, right? Because your entire business revolves around helping leaders lead better, as we've just been discussing. But in your experience, how do you actually define leadership in today's tech-driven environments, right? What are the qualities that you believe are essential for leaders who, frankly, often only have months rather than decades of experience, right? And equally, kind of that differential between leadership versus management, which I think people conflate all too often, or think that, you know, the qualities are the same or similar, when in my experience, they're very different. I, like, as I was saying to you earlier, I'm not entirely sure if I'd consider myself a great leader. I think I am a better leader than many. I am the absolute worst manager. Like, I actively resent having to manage people.
Yeah.
So yeah, would love to get your take on what leadership actually means.
I mean, the bad news is,
go on.
I don't think you can be in a founder role or executive role and not do both.
Yeah. Damn it.
Sorry to say it.
Yeah.
Because who likes to manage? I try to keep...
Well, apparently lots of people. That's a separate question. Yeah. Yes.
I like to keep the answer to this question very simple. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the reasons why I started the company, because so many theories, so many like, oh, every leader is charismatic, every leader needs to be an extrovert. And I'm like, no, I think anyone can be a leader. Mm-hmm. I think great leadership balances across this pendulum that we use between directive and facilitative. Every leader needs to be able to own both of those roles. So you need to know, and directive, I mean, gives direct, like, sets a clear strategy, gives feedback, steps in when it matters. Facilitative is empowers the team, steps off, asks questions. If you can do both of those things, and it's not like one day I'm going to be directive and the next day I'm facilitative, maybe even in a meeting, you're like, right now I need to step in. Okay, right now I need to step out, let them figure it out. Finding that balance allows you to be an all-rounded, great leader, great manager, great visionary. But you have to do it authentically. Mm. So you've got to develop what's my direct... If you're already someone that's, you know, super facilitative, then you've got to learn and stretch into what does directive look like for me, and vice versa. Mm. If you're someone who, like, you know, taking charge is...
second nature.
Yep. Then you've got to learn how to stop talking and start listening.
Damn it.
Yeah. It's horrible. It's a horrible answer. It's not like what no one wants to hear, but I think that's the right balance, the right blend. And funny story, there during the pandemic, at the start of lockdown, I had been working with a CTO who was very directive, like the kind of person that would write a whole email in a subject line.
Oh, yeah.
micromanager, completely disempowered the team. Lovely guy. Actually, and people like working for him. I was talking to someone in his team a few weeks after lockdown, and I was like, how's everything going? Was checking in with all my clients. They're like, yeah, but, you know, he's acting a little strange. I was like, what's happened? It's like, well, he started asking how our family was in our meeting. And now, to most of us, that's not a strange thing.
But coming from someone who's been so...
who has never done it. And I think what happened is he read a magazine around how to lead in lockdown. We all, you know, it's all about ask how people are doing, how is their family. But because, like, he swung too aggressively from directive to facilitative, And it didn't seem authentic.
Yeah.
So it's an important balance to find, but I think that's how I simplify a very complex topic and help people understand and make it accessible.
I understand that balance. I mean, I think, yes, it's critical. Like, you can't be the visionary at the top that just sort of lets the company flounder underneath and just hope that they reach the vision. You've got to be able to set the objectives. I mean, one of the things that I think is really critical to being a great leader is actually accountability, right? Like, yes. it is accepting that the buck stops here, not somewhere else, right?
Yep.
Some of the worst kind of leaders or people who thought they were leaders, and this is why I'm like not a fan of Elon Musk's style of leadership and like his kind of attitude, because it is, and it's a very aggressive US style, I think, way of doing things. And again, I've seen people coming out of Goldman Sachs, etc., have this very similar style where it's like, you know, bum on seat. If I don't see you, you're not working. But if something goes wrong, it's your fault. It's nothing to do with me, right? And there's that disassociation between, you know, me who is setting the objectives and tasks and rules and whatever versus the person delivering them, without sort of taking any accountability for what's going on in the middle. So I completely get that. I think the struggle is always, A, what is that right balance?
Yes.
Right? And clearly that pendulum has to swing during different periods, yep. right?
Yes.
Yep. So there are times you have to be more directive, times you have to be more facilitative. I mean, I guess, you know, bringing it into kind of, a scaling startups landscape, if you like, you know, during a fundraise, clearly a founder needs to be both directive, but also very facilitative, because they're going to be out doing a whole bunch of stuff. They may not be able to do sales as they would have been doing as founders. Yep. They may not be able to kind of manage the roadmap, et cetera, et cetera. So they have to be able to kind of empower ensure that their team both has the tools necessary, but also, essentially has the authority, right, to make decisions.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing that I find, you know, with leadership, and again, on that sort of directive versus facilitative, is understanding how to process failure, right? Like, I think one of the signs and traits of a really great leader is how they deal with failure, either at their level or the business's level, right? Mm. Like, and you know, I don't think it is all about falling on your sword necessarily and just saying, mea culpa, it was all my fault. I think there has to be an element of accountability. Yes, it's happened under my, you know, whilst I was steering the ship, something has gone wrong and I need to deal with it. Now, you could just say, I'm going to deal with it and do nothing, and that's awful. But I think the best kind of leaders actually look at that and try and figure out how to turn that failure into a lesson, how to empower the team based on that failure, right?
Yeah.
And I think the other thing is, you know, it's tough, right? Like, if you are the CEO of a multi-billion-dollar, you know, 5,000 person strong corporation, you are going to have layers and layers and layers of management underneath you, and buffers between you and what's happening on the shop floor, as it were. But when you're in a startup where it's 50 people, it's 100 people, there's still like not that many degrees of separation between you and the people underneath you. And therefore, to an extent, it's actually harder, right? Because you've got to be close enough to the business that you can see what is happening and direct people and equally allow them to do their jobs. But you need to be hands-on hands-on to the extent that you're not out of the woods yet, right? Like, I mean, there's still a business to build.
Mm-hmm.
In some cases, like with the CTO example you gave earlier, it's quite obvious which side of the pendulum they swung on. How easy is it to identify where more work is required? Or do you just take a like more holistic approach where, okay, we've got to build both sides of this, you know, this skill set up? Or do you kind of identify, okay, with this founder, I know I'm going to have to work harder on this side?
I think we always just link it to the strategy.
Mm.
And I think also that's where some their leadership practices take too, for founders specifically, it's too wide, too holistic.
Mm.
We focus in on like And there are, I always joke, like, my husband's a coach, and I'm like, see him if you want to really, like, go deep and search inside yourself. See me if you need to, like, run the business right now. We look at it as, like, what do you need to achieve in the next 3 months? Because if you're raising, then that you've got to be facilitative, and you've got to be directive here. Clear your calendar. What does that look like? What do you need to document? Do we turn you into an AI agent? Like, what's happening so that you can go raise without having to, like, worry or be distracted with things that you shouldn't be dealing with. If you're not raising and you're hiring, then, like, what does onboarding look like for you? How can you be more approachable? Because we're still early, you still matter. FaceTime is really critical. And I think, going back to your point, like, taking accountability earns respect. And I think we shy away from it. We take everything very personally, but actually standing up and saying, I did this because I learned this, and here's what we're going to do differently, or what we're going to do late, like, in the future. So powerful, especially with the up and coming generations. They love it. And I think we also, I often say to founders, like, bring people along with you, because you are going through this internal journey of your own growth. We talk a lot about the business. We don't talk about you. They're always like, well, what am I supposed to say? I was like, just what's on your mind? Like, what article did you read that, like, really fired you up, or you hated, you want to tear up? Like, bring people along that journey, because we want to keep you personified as you scale.
You are a human being as much as you are kind of leader. And actually that's an interesting point, because I think a lot of founders, and this goes back to your point around authenticity as well. I think a lot of founders try to emulate the persona of XYZ person, whether that's Elon Musk, again, to use the wrong example. I'm trying to think of a good example, like Travis Kalanick. No, probably
I
not
actually
that
have, like, I have a thing where I'm like, you're not Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
You're not Jeff Bezos.
Exactly.
You're not.
You are you.
Steve Jobs. Yeah. You are you. Yeah. Do not go, well, oh, Amazon uses 8 pagers. I had a founder who was like, we're going to use 8 pagers. I'm like, you can't even read 8 pages. Like, build the playbooks.
That works for you.
That works for you.
Yeah.
And I think don't be apologetic about the kind of company you're trying to build.
Yeah.
Because there are people for every type of company. There are people that work at one company forever and they love it. Sounds like that's our nightmare. But that's fine. I respect it. And I think, you know, when we're starting to scale and we take things personally when people leave, we then start, the culture starts to be a little bit of everyone's definition. And you lose identity. And I often say we should look to, there's a cult in culture, and it's not an exaggeration. Like, well, don't go too far, obviously. But, you know, we want identity. We want pride. We want passion. We want process priorities, like all that stuff. So people, like, give a shit when they work for you and with you. But yeah, I think we shy. I've just noticed a lot of founders like, ooh, I don't want to.
I think that might also be quite a UK thing. I think it's a cultural thing in the UK. Like, I talk about it a lot. You know, if you look at US founders and you look at UK founders, US founders are far more direct in their ability to say, hey, this is what we're doing. It's going to be bloody amazing. And you should come on for the journey. The UK is sort of, we're trying to build this, and it would be really wonderful if you could join us, you know, and there's, you know, there's a lot of sort of self-deprecation in the US, in the UK kind of language and sense of humor. I wonder whether, I think about this a lot just in terms of, you know, the reality of the sort of generational businesses that have been built, right? If you look at where they've been built, very few have been built here in the UK or Europe. I mean, you know, Spotify, yes, of course, you know, there are certainly others. But we can name the US ones, like, without hesitation, right? Yeah. Like, because they're sitting at the top of the NASDAQ today.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, whether that's Apple, whether that's Google, whether that's Meta, right? Like, Amazon, Salesforce, etc. Like, people know, and they know who the founders were, and they know what the founders say, because the founders are out there saying it all the time. I find it really interesting, as you know, because you're here. You know, this podcast, I talk to a lot of VCs. When I look at where those VCs are active, it's really astounding. The US VCs, predominantly all on Twitter. And it's all kind of very, very train of thought.
Yeah.
this is what popped into my head this last minute. And they have massive followings and you know, that's great. Most of the UK VCs and founders, for that matter, that I know, actually their majority following is on LinkedIn. Like that's where they are. That's where they set up their stall. And the language is so, so different, as we all know. And one could argue what the merits of either platform are. You know, I know that I've been able to build very strong following on LinkedIn, struggle to do anything on Twitter just because they're very different sort of modes of thinking and of writing. I guess my point is I just wonder whether there is something inherently kind of within the UK, maybe even the European culture, that we all, and I've written about this separately, like we have this massive obsession with inherited wealth over earned wealth, right? Yeah. So we almost kind of despise the self-made man, whereas we're more than happy to, you know, tip our caps at someone whose great-great-great-grandfather was, you know, given some land by the king or queen at the time, right? Yeah. Whereas in the US, it's completely the opposite, right? Yeah. You herald the self-made above everything else. And I just wonder whether we need to unlearn some of that to become better leaders, certainly within the tech and kind of venture ecosystem.
Yeah. I mean, as you're talking, it makes me, what comes to mind is I think the media doesn't do us any favors.
Sure.
Because the US media loves the founder story.
Yeah.
The UK media.
Not so much.
Not so much. Yeah. God forbid you try to do something big.
Yeah. No, God forbid you try and do something big and it goes wrong.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, and I say this all the time again, the US like celebrates failure to some extent. Yeah, okay. There's definitely questions. But the UK, we really love stamping down on that. Like, the big one at the moment is, you know, the future fund that was raised during the COVID years. And it's like every other month there's, you know, a Telegraph article like, and you taxpayer money, you know, spaffed up the wall on whatever. And I'm sat there going, there's been like a 6-7% failure rate within the future fund. And I would argue that a lot of the businesses that took money from the future fund aren't necessarily going to be great breakthrough stories, but it only takes a couple, right?
Yeah.
And actually, let's celebrate that rather than, you know, and actually, in any case, what's happened is you've given those businesses the opportunity to keep hiring people, keep employing people, paying back into the coffers, et cetera. So like, it isn't that bad.
Well, and I think like, you know, the media will go after companies like a Revolut.
Mm.
And, you know, because a horrible place to work. Mm. My neighbor worked there. He loved it.
Yeah.
He's like, I know what's expected of me. All the Goldman people love it. Mm. So I think like, instead of just celebrating that we've got companies that are successful, the ones that become successful become, you know, under a microscope.
Yeah.
Everything the founder does, every internal comms is leaked. And like, you know what? Run a business for a day and let me know how it goes for you. And yet we talk about wanting to be this like, I mean, we need to kill the Silicon Valley of X.
Oh God, I hate it.
Dialogue. Yeah. But if we want to even compete at that level, we need everyone in this country to be celebrating founders, celebrating entrepreneurship, making it interesting. And I think we're really lacking an inspiring narrative.
And what the UK keeps trying to do is adopt someone else's narrative. So whether it's we'll be the Silicon Valley of Europe or whether it's we're going to be Singapore on Thames.
Yeah.
It's like, no. Let's be us.
Yeah.
And then we'll figure out
like
how to sell that narrative or we can build on the narrative.
There's enough smart people that can help us do that in this country.
Yeah. I mean, there are, but where are they? Like, I mean, that's that, okay. And now, sorry, we're going to go on from a bit of a tangent now. Sorry. I apologize. But I mean, this has got me thinking, right? You know, there's the old saying, the snake rots from the head, I think. One of the problems, again, here in the UK is the political leadership, quote unquote, right? Which is just uninspiring, has been for like decades now. Whether you love the current government or hate them, or whether you love the prior government or hate them, like I would not say anyone, and I would say I'm fairly apolitical. Like I just want the country to work. Yeah. But I'm incredibly uninspired by any of the leadership that we've seen from the government here in the UK. And I wonder whether that in itself, and so many of those leaders came from journalism, actually, interestingly, came from media. I wonder whether that is part of our problem, because that leadership is maybe a little bit inadequate, that, and they don't have, they haven't been able to build this narrative of identity, certainly around the tech ecosystem. You know, yes, we had, you know, we had Silicon Roundabout. That was great, but that's kind of
disappeared.
Yeah. Like Google Campus disappeared from there.
Yeah.
Tech Nation, obviously, you know, that kind of went by the wayside, you know, and then recently they killed off like whatever, some quantum computing center in Scotland or whatever. Yeah. Like it's so disjointed, so fragmented, and there doesn't seem to, and again, like it's business, right? There is no strategy around tech and venture. It's like, oh, we're doing well, we're punching above our weight. Yeah, we are. You know, we're third behind the US and China, but actually we're like way behind San Francisco, New York, like probably Missouri or something, right? Like, I mean, that's the reality of the kind of level that we're talking about. But actually, we could be so much more. I think it just takes leadership at some level, somewhere, to really be able to kind of grab that narrative by the scruff of the neck and kind of pull it forward, rather than constantly sort of saying, well, we, you know, and again, it's a three-word sort of slogan, you know, whether that's Singapore on Thames or whatever, like that's a wonderful kind of narrative in your own head, but that's all it, like there's no substance to it, right? It doesn't actually get us anywhere. It doesn't tell us how we're going to get there.
No. And I think, you know, I'm British with a North American accent.
Yeah. The best kind,
American passing. I feel like, you know, I moved here 15 years ago. Mm. And started a company 7 years ago. It's not been easy because you're trying to go like this and, you know, things are going like this. It is very attractive, especially when it feels like the whole narrative for founders that are making it, only making it because they go to the US.
Mm.
I was in Singapore last week. Very attractive.
Mm. Love Singapore. 20% tax rate. Like, what's not to love? Yeah.
And, you know, thinking about this conversation and being in Singapore, it's like, make it make sense for me to build a business in this country because I want to. I don't actually want to leave.
UK.
In the UK.
Yeah.
Like, and okay, fine, you've got this black hole that you need to fix, but you're communicating just like power up. Like, we've been powering up.
Yeah. Level up, whatever. Level,
like, oh, we've got to fix the debt and then we'll be out. I'm like, but be out to what?
Mm.
They're not creating
that future
narrative. That I'm like, fine, I'm in it to win it.
Mm.
I will commit. And I'll stay and I'll pay all the taxes. And but like, for what? I think we're missing the for what.
Let me give you the most incredible example I can give. So so everyone in my business, like, no one is employed as yet, right? So I have a couple of consultants, etc. I'm fortunate. One of the beautiful things about my business is because it is fractional CFOs, they're pretty senior. They kind of manage themselves. It's not too difficult. One of my team is based out in Singapore, works for, you know, his day job, his, you know, his 9-to-5, as it were, is working for a really significant kind of hospitality and events business, you know, sort of 5-star luxury type restaurant and hospitality, you know, in Singapore, they're in Dubai, and they were looking at launching in London. And he rings me up and he goes, Arish, can you just tell me something? I say, yeah, what? He goes, 40% tax, is that right? I'm like, what? What do you mean? He goes, well, look, these guys have offered me to come and sort of open up the UK, launch a UK brand. And I'm like, okay, cool. How much? So he asked me, like, how much does a finance director, CFO kind of earn there? I said, well, look, at this sort of level, it would be whatever, 100, 120,000, I would suggest, in that sort of industry. And he's like, oh, okay. And he goes, and it's 40%. But at 120, it kind of starts becoming regressive. He's like, oh. And he said, well, they're not offering me a pay rise. I'm like, okay. And I said, okay, well, here's the thing. So if you move to London, yes, you've got that tax.
Mm.
You got to pay for accommodation in the UK, which is not inexpensive.
Mm.
You've got to potentially put your kids through school if they go, like, because the Singapore schools are pretty bloody good.
Yeah.
So to find an equivalent here, you know, you're not going to be massively happy necessarily with the state system. So you might have to fork out for school fees, which, you know, where there's now VAT on them. So that's a bit more expensive. And by the way, is your wife easier? My wife's working, but she wouldn't be able to because she wouldn't have rights to work here. I'm like, and then I was like, oh, and by the way, if you find accommodation, you're probably going to have to travel in, which is going to be also relatively expensive as well. So I said, look, if I were you, I wouldn't. And he goes, well, yeah, I mean, like, I'm earning that equivalent base in Singapore, but I pay 20% tax on everything. That's it. And I know what the country is doing. I mean, I always argue, right? The Singapore government, it's a bit of a benevolent dictatorship. Get it. But shit works. And actually, one of the reasons it works, and here's an example, and I'm not suggesting that everything is correlated to money, but they pay their politicians a significant amount, which means they are dedicated to making sure the system works, as in making sure the country, the city works, as opposed to here where, like, frankly, you know, UK, the prime minister's salary is lower than a qualified CFO's.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, and that for me, I'm just like, okay, there's a disconnect.
And God forbid he wears a nice suit.
Yeah, and God forbid he wears a nice suit or anything else for that matter at the moment. but when we have leadership that feels like it's second rate, just like when you look around the rest of the world and see kind of what is out there.
Mm.
And I'm not suggesting the rest of the world has it all right. Like, clearly there are lots of places with problems.
Yes.
But yeah, you just feel, and exactly to what, so I came back to the UK in 2015, as I think I mentioned, and I came back for about, you know, I'd been away since 2006, right up until 2012. And I think the point it kind of pivoted or switched was during the Olympics. Things started to look like they were really improving.
Yeah.
So, you know, my wife wanted to come back. I didn't. I was like, I really struggled with the idea. But we came back and I was like, okay, this might be okay. And it was for a year.
Yeah.
Then Brexit.
Yeah.
And then since Brexit, and whether it is, I'm not going to sit here and debate whether, I mean, I have my own opinions, but I'm not going to debate whether it was Brexit or not. But since Brexit, things have been on a downward trajectory from everything that I can see. And exactly to your point, like, I am questioning, I'm asking myself the question constantly, do I want my kids? And my kids are 23 and 17. Is this a country I want them to grow up in? Or to have their future in? Or would they be better somewhere else? Would we be better somewhere else? Like, I'm starting to think, okay, if my business does well enough, you know, do I want to be caught up in a regime that is actually going to make all that success not worthwhile?
Yeah.
Like, it's almost, I feel like in the UK, we'd rather bring people down than raise everyone up to get them to the same level.
Yeah.
And it's problematic.
My husband and I talk about this all the time. Like, they say they want entrepreneurship.
Mm.
Yet if you work a second job and you're full-time employed, well, your second job earnings are taxed
at the same rate.
Yeah. So great. Not happening.
Yeah.
I feel like, you know, everyone talked about the benefits of being a contractor or being self-employed. I started at all the wrong times because it's like everywhere I go, boom, IR35.
Yeah.
Most recently, the national insurance.
Yeah, so there's a national insurance hike. Then there's the dividend tax rates have been changed.
Yeah. What else? Corporate tax always.
Entrepreneurs relief.
I think recently they've just announced they're cutting the young person's visa for those based in the EU.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Great. And I think we are. You know, companies are having to make big redundancies over the past few years, and this is the time to create entrepreneurs and make it interesting. And yeah, I just feel like make it make sense for me to build a business here.
If you are listening, Keir Starmer and the rest of your cohort, Gillian and I want to understand how you're going to make it work for us. Because frankly, we do want to be here.
Yes.
But it's getting kind of hard.
Yeah.
Please. Okay. Well, let's move on because like, frankly, again, that could be a whole podcast in and of itself as well. I mean, look, you touched on this, right? But you suggest that leadership has to align with business strategy. And that seems like a no-brainer.
Yep.
But can you explain more about what you mean? Because from my perspective, leadership sets a strategy. So how can they ever be misaligned? And I guess, what are the consequences if they are?
So this is something when I started this company, I didn't think I'd have to say out loud. But this is what I've witnessed time and time again, is you've got founder set strategy with executive team. Again, pre-Series A, this is very straightforward. And
it's like, get to product market fit. How do we do it?
Yeah. Done. Yeah. Then we get product market fit. We raise money. We're validated. We're starting to get paying customers. We're starting to bring on senior hires. That's always a bit chaotic. What happens is we set a strategy and then 15 different departments go off and execute their own version. And what they create is a me over we mentality. Mm-hmm. And you have all these people who left corporate to, you know, screw the system, I'm going to start my own thing. Yeah. And actually then create and replicate
corporate
a very political system, because founders, I think, underestimate the importance of alignment, and it is hard.
So this is like silos within the organization, essentially.
So like marketing is going off doing this and they're not talking to product. Mm. Sales is talking to customers and no one else.
Mm. They're talking to customers. They're promising features that we don't have yet.
Throwing things over the shelf.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, a significant portion of our work is being in executive meetings, saying the obvious things out loud, but also calling out BS when behaviors don't align with strategy, and forcing a lot of tricky conversations, because sometimes, you know, I try to get teams to just focus on for a year, these are the three bets we're going to make. And that means you can't have 15 bets. And that means some people will not be reflected in these bets. Doesn't mean they're not important. One of the most dramatic moments was this company had great advertising sales. Yeah. They didn't have good like customer sales. The advertising team were killing it. We did a huge transformation there. It was successful. The product sales were diabolical. So I was like, advertising sales can't be in the top three. What would that feel like? And they're like, oh, they'll be really pissed off. I'm like, well, we can manage that through comms. But you need to like force this organization to just focus on one thing and get everyone to think about what's my role, even if I'm in, you know, HR, if I'm in finance, if I'm in ad sales, how do I help product sales? And get everyone aligned to those three things.
Which I guess is somewhat akin to kind of OKRs, right? Objectives, key results, like, which is the famous, one of the famous tools that Google implemented. Yeah, I don't love them. I'm like, I understand them as a tool, but I'm not necessarily bought into the fact that they are the be all end all. I think like every organization has to figure out what works.
Like, it's not, as soon as you adjust as part of the system, it's no longer an OKR.
Yeah.
But we, like, completely bastardized. Like, oh, I want this part and that part. I'm like, then don't call it your own thing. And I actually also, if you are using OKRs and you're not using them the way that Google designed them and you've made some adjustments, like, name it your own thing. Because what happens is, because OKRs are everywhere, you have the person from Google who runs them this way. You have the person from some other company that runs it that way. And now you have seven different people running their version of OKRs. So like, call it your company X thing. Own it, design it for you, but please, no more OKRs.
Yeah.
No more OKRs.
And the other thing is, like, it just gets spot, like, you know, it's Chinese whispers. Like, every team member that's, oh, well, I'm going to go to this company, I'm going to implement this system now. It's what we used at the last company, it was OKRs, and it's actually like a million miles away. I mean, the thing that I find, I think in a larger organization, it potentially works better.
It works. I've used it.
Yeah.
It works when followed.
Yeah.
But as soon as you start adjusting it.
Yeah.
And I don't think it fits for scale-ups.
Yeah, exactly. And I think part of the reason for that is it is very difficult. Like, for example, finance, like, if the company objective is, I don't know, whatever it is, like, build revenue, right?
Yeah.
Like, and not that that should ever be the objective, because that is just like a sine qua non, but, you know, whatever, increase LTV, for argument's sake, right? Finance has a very limited ability to do that, right? As an example, right? So you've got this objective, but how does finance feed into that key result? And then you end up making up kind of or sorry, how do the key results feed into that objective? How do you set the finance OKRs so that they feed into the overall company OKRs? And that can be incredibly difficult. And then you end up sort of Frankensteining something to try and make it, which actually just sets people up for failure, right?
Yeah.
Because it just doesn't get them.
I think at the core, all that matters is that everyone in the company knows what the three focus areas is at any given time. Mm. And if they can influence it, that's what they're focusing on. But I also like, you know, organizations don't run in silos. They run cross-functionally.
Yet well, they should.
They should.
Yeah.
Goal setting is often done by department leads, mm. not by cross-functional leads.
Yeah.
And we're often repeating to leadership teams or any level of leadership that you will, if I had to ask you who your team is, you're going to focus on everyone that reports into you. Mm. But actually your team is the lateral team, mm. is the people that work yeah. across. You should be spending more time building those relationships than those that report into you.
So I'm going to say this, and I'm sure I'll get shot down for having said it. This is why CFOs should be setting strategy, because we yes. literally are about the only people that really truly sit yeah. across all functions, because we have to understand what is going on across all functions in order to build out the strategy and the forecast for the business. And I say all the time, like I remember one of the businesses that, you know, I worked for a couple of years, which went on to exit a couple of years ago for a pretty substantial amount of money. I spent, I think, a couple of days with the head of product, just understanding what the hell the product was. Like,
yeah,
literally, because like not that it necessarily helped in my day to day finance work, but without understanding that, I couldn't do the day to day finance. Like I just didn't have enough of knowledge of the business and how it operated to be able to do that. And equally, I would have to do the same thing with the sales team, with the engineer, with the marketing team, etc. Because again, to your point, all of this stuff has to feed into yeah. the overall objective, without which, you know, you're essentially just pulling in different directions, which is anarchy. Yeah,
I had an interesting case where, you know, a founder, like all about performance, high mm. performance. I mean, which founder isn't?
Me. I'm all about making my life as simple and lazy as possible. But yeah.
But it was like growth, like ambition, let's go faster. And he sent me the draft job page for the website.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, reads very nice. Mm. But I'm like, this is, it, you know, talked about work-life balance and all these perks. And I'm like, no. If you have a founder who can't stop talking about performance, speed, pace.
Why are you talking about this
the
stuff?
The job page mm. needs to reflect the reality of what it's like working.
Yeah. Otherwise
business.
You're going to hire someone that expects this. And, yeah. gets like,
and that's exactly what happened. Then yeah. people are like, oh, I don't like this.
Yeah.
So I think it's like you've got, you know, after leaving my parents' business at 28, it was like starting my career over
yeah.
from
been there.
Ground up.
Yeah.
Recruiters were like, oh, well, great. You know, you've published a book, but we don't really know where to place
yeah,
you.
Yeah, who the hell are you? Like, there are no keywords I can use here.
No.
Yeah.
anyways, found myself in an HR role and in a product studio mm. building software. I always wanted to work in tech. I'd never, you know, had a chance. Mm. So here I was with all these like phenomenal engineers, designers, fantastic studio, founder-led studio. And like, to your point, I immediately just went and sat with the product teams mm. because I'm like, if I had to run a lot of change management mm. and I knew instinctively that if I take the corporate way of change management, I will be spat out very mm. quickly. Mm. So I sat with the product teams, learned their language, you know, it was at times of agile, blah, blah, blah. And I then mirrored how they approach building software to how I was going to approach change management mm. using their language. And we still use that frameworks to today. I have minimum viable change instead mm. of minimum viable product. Mm. And it builds credibility. And I think more people need to sit and understand. If you're in sales, sit with design. If you're in design, sit with marketing. Mm. Your marketing, sit with product. Everyone should sit with finance mm. because no one, you know, we think we understand it, but not really.
No one does. Yeah.
And also get the finance guy on your side or girl.
Yeah. It kind of like it's amazing how many people fight against us. Like the way I describe, you know, what we do as CFOs is like our role is to be like 1 foot, not quite pressing down, but, you know, depressing the brake, but hovering over the accelerator. Yeah. right? So our job is to be like, don't do stupid shit. But if we see an opportunity, let's go for it, right? Mm-hmm. Like, and let's do what needs to be done to get the fuel running through the system. And of course, the fuel is always cash. But it's crazy, right? Like, I mean, I think again, this is another mental, like it's a whole educational piece, right? Like, and again, I talk about this all the time. To your point around language, you know, most people think about finance in terms of, well, if they think about it at all, like debits and credits and like boring crap and all that sort of stuff. I started talking about it as the finance stack and your tech stack within finance like, you know, all this sort of stuff, to your point, minimal viable change, et cetera. You know, when you start using the language that technologists and founders are used to, it becomes easier. The problem is most founders have never been in a situation where they've had to deal directly with anyone in finance. Heck, they've never had, well, they've never had 100,000 budget, let alone, you know, several million suddenly flooding into the balance sheet. The reason we come into business is because we have, and we've done that. We've seen it. We understand how that works. We know what needs to be done. So we're there to kind of help founders figure out where to best utilize their capital and how to maximize the value of their capital, right?
Yeah.
So many founders fight against it. So many.
I think, like, you know, you think that multi-millions will last forever, but like, it
got
goes
in a heartbeat.
Fast.
Well, look, put it this way. £1 million today just about gets you, I would say, 8 months of only, sorry, 1 year of 8 engineers.
Yeah.
That, like, that's how much £1 million will last you. It's not a lot at all. Like, scarily not enough, not a lot at all. And I think founders aren't, like, they overestimate their ability to raise capital again.
Yeah.
And in a market like this, it's tough. Yeah. I mean, like, I've had a founder, you know, was 4 months away from running out of cash, like next to no revenue, had raised during the heyday at like ridiculous valuation, thought they were going to be able to go out and raise again at similar valuations. And I just said, I mean, we're not a magic bullet. We can't create cash out of nothing. Like, I would recommend you don't spend your money on bringing in a CFO and turning your 4 months into 3 months.
Yeah.
I'd focus your energy on finding an investor and, frankly, capitulating to some of the terms, because you aren't going to raise at the same valuation.
Mm.
I don't actually know what's happened to that business. I mean, we didn't work with them.
Mm.
But that overestimation of A, how long the cash is going to last, B, how easy it's going to be able to raise cash, C, of course, and we're all like this, like, as a founder, I always overestimate where revenue is going to be.
Yeah.
Like, that's life. I mean, also,
so it makes us good founders.
Well, I'm also, the problem is I'm meant to be a CFO as well. So I'm like, I'm going to sit there going, Arish, no. That, like, prove to me this is possible. At the moment, it, like, feels like I found the balance, but we'll see. At the end of this year, we'll figure it out. I actually had a question with all of this, because it's been interesting. I've been listening to the language as well. You've mentioned lots of he's when you talked about founders, right? And let's not forget that, you know, there are many, many actually very good female founders out there. And I don't know why I said actually. There are very good female founders out there. I found, and this has been an interesting reflection that I've had over the last several years working with multiple founders, I've tended to find that female founders are much more open to someone like us as CFOs coming into the business and helping them take it to the next level, because I think they're far more aware of where their weaknesses may lay and are willing to take on the support. Whereas I find lots of male founders are that much more kind of bullish. I mean, I'll figure it out myself and it's fine. And I know. And again, there's research that shows that men are much more likely to, again, overestimate their abilities than women are, which is why, like, one of the things that confounded me, I remember when I was hiring in my CTO. So I had a CTO, he left, and I was hiring in a new, or he was leaving, and I hired in a new CTO. And I got one response back saying, I really love this, but I think I'm too junior. And the salary, and actually, so my COO, my current COO, she said to me at the time, she goes, you might want to lower the salary band. I said, what do you mean? She goes, you won't have women apply for this role because they think that it's too high a salary for them. And I was like, well, that was a bit of a wake up call to me. We ended up hiring that person as our CTO. She came on board because her skills were incredible.
Yeah.
Like, they really were.
Yeah.
But yeah, so my question was, I mean, where, do you see a kind of balance across the gender spectrum on all of this as well?
Yes, I'm glad we got here.
We weren't trying to get here, but yeah.
No, I'm glad we got here. So, yeah, I mean, full disclosure, I actually had to take a bit of a break from venture in 2018, 2019, right before the pandemic. So I kind of regret doing that. I was doing a lot of portfolio days for VCs where I was the only female in the room. And after a couple of comments that I was like, I can't believe what's happening. I was like, I don't want to be around this anymore. So it took a break. And also I was, you know, looked at my portfolio and it was predominantly men. So I, one thing I started doing is I started these after hours dinners that were for women in leadership, mixed industry, founder, executive, whatever, come together to have a space just to talk. And we've run, we've just run our ninth. And what's interesting is in those spaces, and I've run female founder accelerator programs for like Google for Startups. And one woman asked, what's the difference between when you run it with male founders versus female founders? And it's very stark difference. Female founders will immediately, and female leaders, will start talking about the real shit very fast. There is no...
like the problems they're facing.
Actual problems. And the conversations are vulnerable, they're open, they're strong, they're empowering, they're insightful. And I've found, you know, I have run a dinner with all male founders and, you know, we just stayed up here. Or I think back to when I was networking for my dad's business. We were part of one of these cringy networking groups that have a, you know, format, and we meet for breakfast every Wednesday. And, you know, we go every Wednesday to a industrial park and have stale croissants and bad coffee and
sit in a circle,
and whatever.
What do I need help with today?
And, you know, get there and how's business? And everyone, it was all men. Oh, it's great. It's great. I'm like, if it was so great,
what are you doing?
Why are we here?
Yeah.
I wouldn't be here.
So, I actually spend more time talking about how bad things are going than how well things are going. I love when things are going well, don't get me wrong. But like, I think actually being honest about the reality of business is so essential, because like, I don't want a generation of founders coming up thinking that business is easy and that like, that it's everyone's bag. Like, I think if you can be a great founder, you'll be a great founder, of course. But do not underestimate how fucking difficult it's going to be, irrespective of how great you will, or you are, or may well be. You are going to face hurdles, whatever. Like, no one in 2020 saw the pandemic coming. That, like, frankly, created a huge amount of problems for a lot of businesses. Clearly, no one necessarily anticipated that the zero interest rate period would end as suddenly and as dramatically as it did, and what that would then mean for private markets, et cetera, et cetera. And then you had elections and et cetera. Like, you cannot control what's happening outside the room. So be honest about it.
Be honest. Like, I had a founder text me today, a friend who's having a tough set, and was like, well, I'm, you know, I'm just building and building and it feels like for nothing. Some deals came through. And I was like, yeah, welcome. Welcome to the process. And like, sometimes life is there just to see how badly you want it. But this is entrepreneurship. And he shared, he's like, I wish I had people to talk to, because all the founders I talk to just say how great everything is. And with that female founder group, you know, they, when I shared like, well, you know, the male founders don't really talk about the reality properly. And I was like, but don't see that as a weakness. Like, I don't want that to be the takeaway, that by you sharing or being vulnerable, you're, you know, I don't know, not playing the game. Actually, all of you get so much more value because, one, you have a community of people to talk to and to actually, like, this is hard and it's going to be hard. And there's no playbook for scaling a company. It doesn't matter how many companies have scaled. You are the only one doing it right now in your business, in your industry. So you're building the playbook as you build, as you grow. Find that community and a people that will be real with you and also hold you accountable, and you can say the hard things out loud. Because I think the more we say that and the more we normalize that entrepreneurship is no cakewalk, and especially through a pandemic and what's come after, you know, it's rough.
And not only that, I mean, like, the thing I would add to that is, you know, I call myself a founder, I'm building a consultancy. It is not a tech business. You know, I'm not aiming to raise venture capital. I try to build a tech business and, you know, built the wrong product for the right product for the wrong market and, you know, all the usual rubbish that people get wrong. But it doesn't matter whether you are building an e-com shop, a consultancy, a coffee shop, or whatever. Like, building a business, irrespective of what the business is tough. I mean, like, I've been in manufacturing, and believe you me, like, B2B SaaS is a cakewalk compared to, like, building a manufacturing business. Okay, take it with a pinch of salt. I know, like, B2B SaaS can be hard, right? But but the point is, like, when you're dealing with, as I was, in a country in the middle of nowhere, you know, 4 month lead times, payment at site, you know, goods sitting at the wharf for another 4 months because, like, there was no one to take them off.
Tariffs on steel.
Well, actually, this was chemicals, but yeah, tariffs on chemicals, like a cash payment system in the country because you're selling to, like, little smallholders in the middle of nowhere. Like, we had 6 month working cap, like 9 month working capital cycles in some instances. If you can figure out how to make cash flow work in that environment, Jesus Christ, you can probably make it work anywhere else, right? But the point is, that had its set of difficulties. This has its set of difficulties. And whatever I do next will have its set of difficulties on the assumption I build something else. I mean, like, even this podcast, which is not a business by any stretch of the imagination, was never intended to be. I still think about it in terms of business. Like, what is ROI? How am I doing? Mm-hmm. What am I actually attempting to do here? And there are days where I feel like, Jesus Christ, this is really bad. Like, this is, you know, this is tough. This is hard. And I've come in again and, like, Jesus Christ, no one's noticing or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, like, actually, as I've now probably said on this podcast way too often, we went from 540 subscribers on October the 7th last year to 5,000 2 weeks later and now 22,000 2-3 months afterwards, right?
Phenomenal.
So when it happens, it happens. The inflection point can happen. But, like, the slog doesn't stop. Like, that inflection point wasn't suddenly, oh wow, okay, everything's right now, I can stop.
Yeah.
Actually, if anything, you got to work harder, right? Because you got to keep that momentum and you got to keep building.
Yeah.
I'm glad you talked about, you know, that sort of break from the VC ecosystem as well a little bit, because, you know, I think, and we talked about this earlier, right? In stark contrast to their counterparts in the US, I think there's a lack of outspoken leadership here in the UK, certainly in the UK, probably Europe-wide, within the venture capital ecosystem. Although I think some of the successful founders or more successfully exited founders tend to be a bit more vocal than others, often have moved to the US and have adopted kind of the norms and the language. So how do you think leaders in this space can be more influential, right? And actually have their voices heard? And why is it so important to say things out loud? And this kind of goes back to what you were saying about the female founders, like vocalizing where the problems are. Like, how do you look at the ecosystem today? And I guess, how can we be better at being more open, honest, and showing our leadership?
Yeah, I mean, I think coming into the venture capital system, I always joke to my friend, like, who has no idea about VC, and I'm like, I remember those days.
As it turns out,
sometimes I wish I was on that side.
Yeah.
But it's a lot of smoke and mirrors, right? And closed circles and closed doors, and that's fine. And it's, you know, in a lot of ways orchestrated to do that. I think as we are seeing more and more emerging fund managers, it's an exciting time for venture to take a new point of view or a new stand, especially in this country and especially in Europe. I think, similar to what we were saying earlier, drop the whole Silicon Valley of X. Like, think about the point of view you want to have in market and talk about it. I say that, I get, at the same time, you don't want to give away all your cards if you're, you know, but there's a way.
But you can't. You never do. Like,
no.
Yeah.
And I think, I know Fred Destin's been on this podcast and says the thing, like, notorious for saying the things out loud, and made an announcement a few weeks ago about Fund 3.
So his announcement about not raising Fund 3 was like a few months ago. And then I think a week or two ago, he made the announcement that they deployed the last capital out
that
of
was
Fund
it.
2.
Yeah.
Right, yeah.
And, well, that was the one I came across.
Yeah.
And when you look at the comments, it's from founders going, thank you for being honest. And I think that
sorry to interrupt. Like, one of the things he said on this podcast was, And I actually, like, I almost stood up and applauded him for saying it, he was like, I know when people are coming onto my LinkedIn and commenting it's because they want money from me.
Yeah.
Like, I know that.
Yeah.
And I think about this a lot. Like, I built a relatively large following on LinkedIn, but I'm not an investor. I know my angel friends, they get a lot more engaged than I do because essentially people are like, okay,
I'm gonna
try and wheedle my way into kind of figuring out how I can get some cash out of this guy. Whereas I'm probably the guy that is gonna help them to not need the cash. But anyway, that's a separate matter. But yeah, no, look, I mean,
I think there's some firms that are doing a great job. I think Kindred, Atomico, like, you're seeing the face behind the check and they're coming out with points of view and they're talking to founders, and I think they're doing it in a really clever way because it's not copycatting the US. I've seen some folks in the UK try to copy the US.
Well, as an example, there's every other month there's a VC firm that tries to build the new all-in pod for the UK.
Yeah.
And like, it won't work here because no one in this ecosystem is going to come out and say the batshit crazy stuff that the guys in the US say. Like, no one is going to come out and say what David Sacks says in the UK. Like, they just wouldn't.
And I think we just have, like, meet people where they are.
Yeah.
And, like, know your audience, know who you are, but have a point of view. Mm. And I do think, like, for the emerging fund managers, it's a great opportunity to stand out. Mm. Don't use AI. And I think that's what I'm seeing a lot is, like, clearly AI generated content. Yeah, it's been mass, but like, what are your points of view? What are you like, we need to bring people on your journey, both from a startup and like, why should founders take checks from you?
I got a really good recommendation there. Come on this podcast.
Yes.
As many people do.
but also for your GPs. And I think having worked in and around venture, there is an apprehension to step outside, right? Mm. And I get it. Like, I wish I didn't have to be on LinkedIn, but it's great for business. So we rationalize it and get over our fears. But think about what's in the best interest for your firm. Mm. And maybe it's not you, the managing partner. Maybe it's three levels down and getting your principals to talk. Mm. But get out there, have a point of view, make it exciting. But I think we need to break, or it's already breaking, the walls are starting to come undone, and you can sit there on your hands and go, I wish things were like they were, or you can see this as a great opportunity to come out, stand out in a very, you know, messy market.
Yeah. I think again, it's interesting. What I tend to see, and I'm involved with a lot of emerging managers, I guess, from that perspective, right? Like, there is this, there is obviously a hesitation, right? Until you've raised your fund, like, I think founders underappreciate, for example, the fact that VCs probably spend more of their time fundraising than founders.
Yeah.
And it's probably harder.
Yeah.
Because the people that they're raising checks from, like, are very, very conservative often, right? Yeah. You know, because you are talking about corporate stroke, you know, pension funds or whatever, right? Like, these are not people that want to, like, they are, their risk appetite is not huge, and their allocation towards venture is very small. Like, I think people, you know, again, it's very easy to get caught up in this ecosystem and think this is everything. But if you think about most, like, family offices, for example, like, the allocation towards venture is going to be 5%, 10% of their total. It's like, nothing compared to, like, their property holdings or their, you know, listed equity holdings or whatever. So it's hard to get that cash in. I think emerging managers, you know, actually, again, Fred said this, right? It's fine to be a generalist. It's not okay to be generic.
Yeah.
Right. And I think, you know, emerging managers, I think, are best when, to your point, they have a very solid opinion. Like, their opinion could be wrong as far as you or I are concerned, but it's their opinion. Doesn't matter.
And we won't find out for another 7 years,
right? Yeah. But the point is, like, if they have conviction, that's fine. The worst have been the kind of tourist VCs that have come in and, okay, well, you know, 50-minute grocery and now it's AI.
What's a tourist VC?
Like, so during the kind of 21, 22 years, it's sort of Tiger and these guys who came in and are like, oh, wow, VC looks really easy. We're just going to start flooding the market. Yes. So people that I talk about as wantra capitalists and wantrepreneurs, right? Like, people who see the headlines and are like, oh, this looks like a fun, easy thing to do.
Yes.
I'm going to do that, right? And I've seen lots of people that have gone into entrepreneurship thinking, well, it's fine. I'll just raise some money and like, yeah, happy yeah. days. And then it's like, oh, shock to the system. I actually got to do stuff and maybe, you know, create some value. And VCs were like, okay, well, I haven't personally come across many of these, but I certainly know lots of people that want to get into venture. Like I thought about it a million and one times. I'm really close to the ecosystem. I would probably make a really bad VC. Maybe not. I don't know. But yeah. like it, where I am today, I'm not sure that I would. So I've debated whether I raise a fund, don't raise a fund. And I've, for the time being, landed very much on the side of don't want to raise a fund because I don't want to take risk with other people's cash unless I am serious, like unless I have an absolute conviction that what I'm going to invest in makes sense, you know, for, you know, to be able to to be able to return money to them. But I also think that, and again, it comes back to this whole thing about leadership, right? Like it is having courage of your, you know, to use the cliche phrase, having courage in your own convictions, being able to stand up and saying, this is what I stand for. This is what we stand for. This is who we are, rather than we're just like a carbon copy sort of Play-Doh replica of XYZ firm over there or XYZ country over there.
Yeah.
And we're going to do the same things. Like, you know, in the UK and Europe, we clearly have really strong capabilities within research, within science. Like, let's double down on that. Let's make sure that that's the narrative that we're putting out there. And yeah, look, I mean, if we could, you know, and actually fintech again, like we know
exactly.
that we're pretty good in the UK.
Yeah.
Double down on like, you know, why not have more conviction around that? Now, look, I'm not suggesting that, you know, fintech is the only place or, you know, deep tech is the only thing that you should be investing in by any stretch of imagination. But I think we need to have opinions that can stand alone. Like, and it doesn't matter if your opinion is the same as someone else's. That's fine. You don't have to be performatively contrarian just for the sake of it.
Yeah.
But have an opinion.
Yeah, and share the opinion.
Yeah.
Because I think it does everyone a disservice that you have these smart, very smart people on venture who are keeping all of that insight to themselves.
Yeah. I know a platform, again, I mean, like, I'm sorry, just come on here, talk about it. Like, seriously, please. Listen,
it's a safe space.
It is a safe, well, I mean, I hope it's been a safe space. Gillian, look, again, we probably could talk for another hour, so I think I'm going to have to probably draw a line. So I have one final question, which I'll ask all my guests. What is one thing that you have a contrarian conviction about from any area of life, whether that's work, politics, socially, or at home? What is the hill that you would die on defending?
So it's as it relates to building a company, there is a time and place for tyranny.
Care to expand?
I think it like loops back to everything we've said.
Yeah.
And it's...
I know what you mean.
When you're running your business, sometimes you've just got to, doesn't matter how much you've tried to empower the team.
Yeah, shut up and get on with it.
Just do it.
Yeah.
And we're going to do it my way.
Yeah.
And you don't have to have all the facts and figures. And I know this is going to make me very popular with founders and very unpopular with all those that work with them.
It's fine.
But it's your business. It's your baby.
Yeah.
And although we want you to disassociate with it a little bit, when you're in that building phase, like you've just get in there. Don't hold back. Don't ask for permission. And sometimes break the rules a little bit.
Yeah, I don't disagree at all. I mean, like, and this was actually one of the biggest learnings when I was working for kind of my family enterprise, because I was having to ask for permission. There were things that we could have done that would have been incredibly value additive that we didn't do because I was told, well, you don't know.
Yeah.
You know, you've not done this before. You don't know. And now because I can. I mean, these are two slightly different points. I can take the bets that I want to take, but when I see someone in, so actually I've become more prescriptive about how I want us to work with the companies that we work with, because I've now been through like whatever 70 companies that we worked with. And I'm like, okay, this is the pattern of what goes wrong and why it goes wrong. So let's, okay. Like you may want to do it that way. Cool. But if you're doing it for me, via me, then you're going to do it this way, because that's the only, that is the way that we protect ourselves and how we get the best outcome for our clients. And yes, I think and this comes back to your directive facilitative point, it's too easy to kind of sit there and go, okay, it's fine, do it.
Yeah. You know, I've hired a senior exec.
We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, no.
When it comes to the crunch,
yeah,
and there are dollars on the line, you might need to just step in and say, actually, you know what? Sorry, this is how we're going to do it.
And it shouldn't be the default state.
Yeah.
Just to preface that. But there's a time and place for it, and like own your bets.
Yeah.
So if you do get involved and it ends up being a big mistake, then like own it and we move on.
Yeah.
Don't blame other people.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think
we've come full circle.
Yeah.
Gillian, it's been absolutely incredible having you,
thank you,
here. I think we've given the editors an interesting, so they have to listen to each episode as it comes out. So I think they're going to have a bit of a romp around the question of leadership when they listen back to this. Mm. I actually honestly could have sat here and probably done another couple of hours.
Same.
In the meantime, though, for our audience, where can they find you online? Are you on LinkedIn, Twitter? Where can they find you on the interweb?
I have left Twitter. I think my profile's still there. Mm. You can find me on LinkedIn. Mm. It's my primary professional domain.
Okay, well, we'll be dropping a link in the show notes.
Thank you.
In the meantime, thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
No, thank you for having me.